Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Greetings, friends of Fly Fishing Journeys. This is your host, Rob Giannino. I was thrilled to have Ted Williams of the Native Fish Coalition on the podcast. Ted is an amazing man and has made a career in writing and conservation. As a conservation writer for Fly Rod and Reel, The Nature Conservancy, and others, his voice and pen have been on the leading edge of fish and habitat protection for years. I hope you are as excited as me with things starting to open up and a light appearing at the end of the tunnel. This has been a tough few months really for everyone. One bond we all share is we all have been affected in some way by the difficulties of the first half of 2020. But just like the book Halftime my pastor gave to me when I turned 40, it's only halftime in 2020, and I look at turning the second half of this year on its head and making the rest of the year an amazing adventure. Speaking of that, we're picking up our travel schedule in mid-June and going to start getting back on the road. We're heading to the Golden Trout Wilderness in California, where I'm going to hopefully catch the fish that I've been chasing for nearly 20 years, the golden trout. I will be joined by Mikey Weir of Caltrout and my son Tyler as we are heading into the Sierra Nevadas via horse pack train. We'll camp and fish up the mountains deep into the native golden trout heaven. We'll also fish for Kern River rainbows. Kind of a dream come true, especially with my son. For more information on a trip like this, visit goldentroutpacktrains.com. We will be doing a podcast and a vlog with these guys, so stay tuned. I am also so excited to announce the Fly Fishing Journeys app is now available for Android devices as we are live on the Google Play Store. The iOS app in the Apple Store just got updated to version 1.0.3, so if you have the app already, you can update it in the App Store. Version 3 is the version I had in my mind when we started down the app process. With an app, it can take a minute to get to your destination. The new version is clean, easy to navigate, and has all the direct access to the podcast, the video vlogs, the written blogs, and the social media community. It's something we have worked very hard for, and I hope you find it enjoyable and functional. It's free for now, and we'll keep it that way if I can. My biggest ask is for you to download it, use it, and shoot us feedback. If you could also leave a review in the App Store, that will help the app get found as well. A big help is also supporting our sponsors as they make all this work together. We have some great ones, including Bissell Insurance, Norvice, and The Fly Fishing Show. What do I love about Bissell Insurance? Well, they are the only insurance agency endorsed by AFTA, the American Fly Fishing Trade Association. If you're a business, a lodge, or a guide in the fly fishing or outdoor industry, you really want to give Art at Bissell Insurance a call. You can find them at BisselInsuranceAgency.com. After using my Norvice for almost a year now, I can easily see why it's called the most innovative fly tying system on the market. When people come by the booth at the fly fishing show and see my Norvice, they love it. Either they have one and want to talk about it, or they really want to get one. Some of the main advantages of the Norvice is not only does it rotate, but it fully spins, making your fly tying more efficient and often faster. To check out the Norvice, some online videos, and have access to their online store, visit nor-vice.com. Now let's head to the podcast.
I could not be more proud to be here at the Marlboro Fly Fishing Show with none other than conservation legend, Mr. Ted Williams. Ted, thank you for being on our podcast.
Good to be with you.
Well, we need to give people a bit of background, not that people don't know, but for those that may not know, Ted, you are the national chair of the Native Fish Coalition. You are a longtime columnist with the Nature Conservancy. Many would argue that you're the foremost conservation writer in America today. You're a 30-year columnist with Audubon, a conservation columnist with Fly Rod and Reel for maybe around 20 years, which we can talk about, and then you wrote the book Something Fishy.
Right. A rare book.
A rare book.
The only kind I write.
Well, it's been great to have you here, sir. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about your work with the Native Fish Coalition. Why are you so passionate about native fish?
Well, we feel that the public fish really don't count as wildlife. Most of the public sees them as something to bend their rods or pose gracefully on toast. But we're not a fishing group. We're a native fish conservation restoration group. We believe in restoring all fish that are native, whether you can catch them or not. One of the biggest threats to native fish is bucket biology, where the public and sometimes managers stock non-native alien fish on top of wild fish or hatchery fish on top of wild fish. We're trying to get that stopped or slowed.
So do you see that as a big problem? I mean, that way, if you're like in the state of Massachusetts or New Hampshire or even Vermont, I mean, goodness gracious, and all over the country, that's the put and take mentality sometimes.
Right. We're not against stocking. We're not even against put and take in the right water. I love to fish the Cape ponds. They're put, take, and grow ponds, and we wouldn't have any trout in those ponds if it wasn't for stocking. What we object to is stocking hatchery trout on top of wild trout. You wind up with fewer trout and poorer fishing.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about your role with the Native Fish Coalition.
Well, my biggest role is doing our blog. You know, I try to put two or three articles up per day.
TED Talks.
TED Talk. Some commentary. Sometimes I write them. Mostly they're just links that I find that are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Having to do with fisheries management issues, not just freshwater, saltwater too. We're trying to get our members more interested in saltwater marine fish conservation.
So tell me about your work with Audubon. You were with Audubon for 30 years as one of their top conservation columnists. What was that like?
It was great. They let me say a lot. They sent me places. Audubon, like a lot of hard copy, has been hurt by the internet. When I started with them, you know, we had like a couple hundred pages, and now they're...
A couple hundred pages per magazine?
Per magazine.
And how many issues at that time?
It was always six.
It's always been six.
Yeah, but now they... It was a good run, a good outlet for me, but they want almost only bird articles. And I want to write about birds, but not just birds. I want to write about mammals and fish and reptiles and amphibians and plants.
Are you still a writer with Audubon?
I haven't for a couple of years. If they asked, I would. I write a monthly column for the Nature Conservancy called Recovery.
Okay.
And I'm really enjoying that. I love the Nature Conservancy. They're really an effective group.
Tell our listeners about the Nature Conservancy, because many of them may not know.
They keep a low profile, and they're only into recovery projects. They buy up and protect a lot of land. They do great work. They do a lot of work on islands that are taken over by alien rodents, rats and mice. It's controversial because the only way you can get rid of these rodents is to go in there and put rodenticide. And you're going to have some non-target mortality.
Mm-hmm.
It never amounts to much. It's never ecologically significant. But the public doesn't understand like that. And the islands that they've done it, for instance, they just did a project on Desecheo. It was mostly the island conservation and a group called White Buffalo. And this is a refuge off of Puerto Rico. And it was taken over by... Somebody released macaque monkeys there in the 60s, and they took over the island. It was one of the most important seabird nesting islands in the Caribbean, and they eliminated all the seabirds, the monkeys.
Wow.
So my friend Tony DiNicola, who runs White Buffalo, went in there with Wildlife Services, and they eliminated the macaques. It was really tough. The first 90%, not too hard, they shot them. But in the last 10%, they'd sit in the 95-degree weather all day and get one monkey. And finally, they had to go to Puerto Rico and bring some Judas monkeys in and put transmitters on them. And you know, some of the public didn't like that. In Puerto Rico, it wasn't a problem because the macaques have overrun the island, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're destroying people's gardens and spreading disease.
Right.
So that was a low-profile project. And just in a couple of years, the island is blossomed. Native endangered cactus has come back. All the birds are back.
Nice.
Island Conservation and the Nature Conservancy, they do a lot of these projects all around the
world. Now, how did the monkeys get there?
Some researcher in the 60s had them there doing some experiment, and they got loose. And
really?
And they overran the island, and they were a disaster. And the animal rights folks kind of don't get it, why we have to eliminate the non-natives. Their argument is, well, they didn't ask to be put there. That's true. But you're not helping by just sitting around and watching. Letting nature take its course does not involve sitting on your hands and watching mistakes unfold.
Where did you grow up, Ted?
I grew up in Winchester, Massachusetts.
Winchester?
Yes.
I'm from Billerica.
Oh, really? Okay.
We're neighbors.
Well, my father worked in Billerica when I was a kid.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That is awesome. And so he was a huge baseball fan.
No, he wasn't. Neither of us were baseball fans.
Okay.
Well,
you share the same name as a very famous baseball player.
I do, and I used to interview Ted, the real Ted Williams, as I've heard him called to my chagrin.
The real. And this is Ted on Ted interview here.
Right, and we talked about, I was doing a piece for Smithsonian on Atlantic salmon restoration.
Okay.
And he gave me these fabulous quotes. There's a profanity in every sentence. And of course, the editors took it all out and made him sound like Casper Milktoff. It was really unfortunate.
Yeah, it would have been nice to get the real Ted.
And all my life, they've heard of him and not me, but once it happened in reverse.
That they heard of you and not him.
And he told me about it, so I know it's true. He was fishing in the Bahamas, and his guide said, Mon, he says, I got to say, I love your fish articles. And Ted said, you got it wrong. I'm not the writer, I'm the baseball player. And the guy says, oh, I don't play baseball. Never heard of him.
So he was really looking for you.
Right.
That's awesome. Well,
only once.
He was quite a fisherman.
He was, yeah.
And he loved his Atlantic salmon.
He did, and his bonefish and tarpon.
His bonefish, tarpon, Atlantic salmon, right.
Yeah.
And he would be up where? The Ristigouche or
Miramichi.
The Miramichi?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been up that way?
I have.
With Ted?
No, but he invited me one day, and I couldn't go. But I fish all the same waters that he did. Now the stripers have taken over the river.
That's really unfortunate.
They're native there, but they were never there in the numbers that they are now. And nobody's sure why they're there. It might be global warming, but they're chowing down on the smolts coming down the river.
That's not good at all.
Not good, no. So they started a commercial fishery, trying to get them knocked down a little bit.
Yeah, lower their numbers.
Right.
So you were born in Winchester. Mm-hmm. Your dad was a sportsman, or?
No, not at all. No interest. My uncle, two uncles were my grandfather.
Okay.
So that's where I got to learn about fishing from them.
And how did that happen?
Well, we have a place in New Hampshire, in a lake, Big Island Pond in Derry and Hampstead.
Okay.
And that's where I learned to fish with those guys. And I still go up there. We still have. I wound up with a camp my grandfather built.
Okay.
So we go up there a lot. My son's up there this weekend.
And then you grew up as a teenager and kept fishing. And how did fly fishing get introduced to this process?
Well, my grandfather gave me a fly rod when I was 10.
Okay.
And he took me up to Canada to fish for brook trout. I wanted to learn how to double haul. So this old boy was teaching me on the dock, and he said, let me see your cast. And he said, you're already double hauling. That's what you would do if you wanted to get more line out.
Wow.
It's not complicated. It's common sense. These various schools make it seem very complicated.
Do this, do that, do the other thing.
It's, you know, I could have a non-fly fisherman fly fishing in 2 hours. You know?
So it was natural for you, that whole motion of the haul, the double haul?
Sure. Yeah, for anybody. Just do it a little. And
so then you fished in New Hampshire as a teenager. You got to go to Quebec a little bit.
Right.
Now into your 20s, what was next for you? Did you go to college?
I did. I went to Maine, Colby and Maine. And
Colby College.
A lot of good fishing up there. I spent more time in ponds than I did in the classroom. also grouse hunting and woodcock hunting in the fall.
So you're a Mainer.
Well, I was then.
And Mass, New Hampshire, and now Maine.
And I worked up in Maine after I graduated on the early log drives, so pulp logs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun.
Do you have some favorite Maine waters that you like to recreate, or back then even?
Back then, I spent a lot of time in a 10,000-acre tract north of the Forks.
Okay.
Fished a lot up there. I still go up there a little bit.
You ever get into the rapid or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Big brook trout.
Although the rapid has been taken over by smallmouth bass. You probably heard about that.
Yeah.
Coming out from Bagog.
Yeah.
Unfortunate. That's, you know, it's temperamental. If you can get one trout a day, you've done well in the rapid.
Mm-hmm.
But they're there.
Yep.
Salmon, too.
And then, so tell me about your work with Fly Rod and Reel.
Well, that was a great outlet for me. I've learned that if you want to write reel conservation, you got to find a small magazine. Because if you write for a big one, they're worried about offending advertisers, and you really can't say much. And Fly Rod and Reel was great. I had good editors. Paul Guernsey, still a close friend. We fish in Quebec together still. He was the editor for like 10 years. Jim Butler before that. And they let me do anything.
Mm-hmm.
We named names. We didn't hold back. And it was a great outlet. And unfortunately, it went belly up.
How long ago?
I think it was like 2 years ago, 3 years maybe.
Not long.
No, pretty recent mortality.
Mm.
Unfortunate. But I think that was a victim of the internet too.
Yeah. What were some of the big stories over the years that caught a lot of attention?
Let's see. Do you know about Paiute cutthroat trout?
No.
They were the
Paiute?
Paiute. Like the Indian.
Paiute, okay.
They are the rarest trout in North America.
Okay.
Their entire range is Silver King Creek in California, in the High Sierras. And they were in the process of going extinct from being hybridized by alien rainbow trout that somebody had dumped in there. We're not sure if they were managers or bucket biologists, but a long time ago, and they were being converted to mongrels. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and California Department of Fish and Wildlife and Fish and Wildlife Service for 10 years tried to get a rotenone project. Luckily, some sheep herders had thrown them up over an impassable dam 100 years ago. So there was a reservoir of pure fish. Had they not done that, we would have lost the cutthroat. So, unfortunately, environmental groups don't, a lot of environmental groups, not all of them, don't recognize fish as wildlife. So any poison, they're against.
Mm-hmm.
So for 10 years, with lawsuits, these groups shut down the recovery. They almost succeeded, but about 2 years ago, they finally rotenone the stream, 11 miles. Rotenone is organic pesticide. It's applied at 50 to 100 parts per billion, not million, per billion. It's so short-lived that it sometimes can lose its toxicity in 1 hour. And it's easily neutralized below the site. And it's never been seen to harm or to hurt a native ecosystem or even change it except to restore it for the long term. So, unfortunately, a lot of these groups shut this down with lawsuits. And finally, it was done. And it's the only fisheries recovery project that has restored or is in the process of restoring a native fish to 100% of its former habitat.
That's phenomenal.
It's a huge success story. So I've written about that a lot.
Is that about a Bishop? The Bishop area?
No, it's just the High Sierras. It's like a 15-mile walk up there.
Okay.
And some of these groups are saying, well, you know, this is only a project so people can catch fish. Well, they imagine that anglers want to hoof it up 15 miles into the High Sierras to catch 8-inch trout. That's not why Trout Unlimited did it. This is a native species, wildlife. It's a fish, and it needed to be restored. And unfortunately, there's a lot of projects like that, around, especially in the West, that are being stymied by chemophobes who fear any poison, who misread Rachel Carson. And Rachel was never against short-lived herbicides or pesticides. In fact, she advocated them. She was against the chlorinated hydrocarbons and long-lived DDTs, relatives. And that's what was killing the wildlife and endangering the public.
Mm-hmm.
Not these invaluable tools that we we have to restore native ecosystems.
Yeah. So what's the Native Fish Coalition up to these days? What is the big push that you guys are working on? I know you did your sign project last year.
The sign project is very important to convince people to treat these native fish respectfully, especially the Atlantic salmon, which you can't even target. They're so rare now. Man.
Tell our listeners about the sign project that you and Bob and the entire Native Fish Coalition were so busy championing last summer.
Placing them in strategic waters.
And what did they say? What was the message of the sign?
Please, I can't quote you exactly, but we have them in the booth. Please respect these native fish. Handle them carefully. Atlantic salmon, don't take them out of the water. It's illegal to take them out of the water. It's illegal to target. If you catch one by mistake, help us save this rare species.
Yeah, and then a lot of brook trout signs too.
Exactly.
And then the char.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that we have landlocked Arctic char in Maine, the only state where we have native char left. We had them in New Hampshire, Vermont. Those have been extirpated largely by stalking alien fish like lake trout, which hybridized with them. Unfortunately, we have these bucket biologists that illegally add non-native fish to these trout ponds, and that's really hurt brook trout water in Maine and char water. And a good example is Big Reed Pond, which had a really healthy population of Arctic char, or blueback trout as they're called.
Bluebacks.
Blueback, same thing. And somebody thought that if they added smelt, they'd grow bigger.
Mm.
And it worked. They grew to 20 inches. But what they didn't understand is that the smelt ate the fry, the char, and they were in the process of wiping out the char from Big Reed.
Mm.
Finally, with pressure from fish conservationists, the state rotenoned the pond with the help of the Nature Conservancy, which owns the land. And the Nature Conservancy, to its credit, was unfamiliar with rotenone. They were skeptical. Here was a poison. But they listened. This is a short-lived poison, the only tool we have for saving these rare fish. And they were on board. And they evacuated 20 or 30 of all they could catch, raised them in hatcheries, wiped out the smelt, and restocked. And it was also brook trout, native to Big Reed. And we've got the char reproducing. They reproduce much more slowly than brook trout. And we were worried that they weren't going to do it, but last year we had evidence that they did. So that's very encouraging, but a lot of ponds, former brook trout ponds, have been wiped out by stalking bass or perch.
That's unfortunate.
Very unfortunate, yeah. That's another big push for the Native Fish Coalition is stopping illegal stalking. That's, in Maine, that's probably the biggest threat.
Yeah, people don't understand. They think they're just kind of, it's good for them. Well, good. So you've been a longtime writer. Is that a passion of yours, writing?
It is, yeah. I really enjoy it.
I like to write articles, and I like to finish product. But for me, the audio has always been a little bit more streamlined, and I have some ideas, but getting them out of my head onto the paper is difficult.
For me, it's the opposite. It's hard for me to communicate verbally.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, I'd rather write.
You'd rather write. Well, good, and you've been doing that a long time. Now, coming out of Colby in your 20s, graduated, what was next for you after that?
Master's in journalism at Boston University.
Okay.
And then I went to work for the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife.
Oh, you did?
For 5 years, and I did their magazine and their news releases. And that was fun, and I learned a lot, and I made a lot of good friends.
Yep.
But I really didn't fit in. They didn't want what I wrote. They wanted me to
be a little bit more vanilla?
Where they're stalking the big ones, and I wanted to write about environmental issues.
Interesting.
But they let me have quite a lot of freedom. It was a good gig for 5 years.
And then what happened? Where did you go next?
Then I went freelancing.
Okay.
It was a hard transition, but it worked.
So you're probably around your 30s at this point.
I left when I was maybe 28.
Okay.
Yeah, went freelancing. And then I went to work. I got some good gigs at Audubon and a few others. Wrote for Smithsonian a little bit, Modern Maturity. They wouldn't let me subscribe because I wasn't old enough, but they let me write for them.
And so it's just been a series of writing for you for your life.
Yes.
You've been a writer your whole life.
Yes.
And that's basically been the extent of your career as far as your jobs.
Right.
That's amazing. To make an entire career out of writing.
There's only one job you could do to make less money, and that's being a light tackle fishing guide. So I'm thinking about doing that.
That's next.
Yeah, that's next.
You picked that up.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's awesome. And then you wrote the book Something Fishy.
Right, right. And a few others. All rare books.
Tell me about the Something Fishy. What was the theme? What is the...
It was a compilation of articles I'd written for various magazines. Just a kind of a collection.
But it was all along this idea of protecting the environment.
Protecting native fish, yeah.
Native fish.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the state of the health of our fishing resource right now?
Well, it depends. It's very variable. Salt water, we're doing pretty well. We just passed the Modern Fish Act, which, if you read it a year ago, it was an absolute disaster.
Yep.
And Congress picked at it until it's not bad. Not great either, but it's not going to hurt anything.
Okay.
We have Magnuson Act has brought back a lot of fish. It's very successful. Overfishing is illegal under the Magnuson Act. It was a big effort to weaken it. It failed. Freshwater depends where you are. I mean, you got to hand it to the bass anglers because they taught everybody else to release fish.
Yeah.
I'm not a big tournament fan, but at least they're releasing them. And they got the salmonid anglers to start releasing.
Mm-hmm.
So that has helped. Catch and release has caught on big time. And
yeah.
It's necessary because there's so many people fishing.
Yep.
Bob and I were talking earlier about Atlantic salmon restoration, and some people say it's a huge disappointment because it's not going to work in New England. But because of that effort and because of all the fish passage and clean water, we have 10 other anadromous species that are doing fantastic because of the salmon restoration. So I did a piece for Patagonia called Everything But Salmon about all these other great fish that have come back and forage fish that are feeding saltwater fish, herring and analogs. In Maine, I'm sure you've heard of some of the tremendous runs we have now of analogs. That's fueling the whole marine ecosystem. Everything from lobsters to birds to stripers to sharks to marine mammals.
Do you have any big fish destination plans this year, or what's on the calendar?
I do.
Where you headed?
In a couple of weeks, we're going to Key West.
Oh, nice.
To fish for Albies. They call them Bonito.
Bonito.
I can't do that yet.
No, no. You're from New England.
Albies and King Mackerel and Jack Crevalles.
Nice.
And Blackfin Tuna.
Where do you stay?
We've rented a house. I'm not sure where it is. My friend set it up. But there's like six of us going down, and we fly fish. But it's a different kind of fly fishing. I mean, anybody could do it. You catch a bunch of pilchards, and you don't go unless you have 1,000 pilchards. And you start throwing the live ones. You anchor. It might take 20 minutes, might take 2 hours. But eventually, there's all these explosions behind the boat, and you swing down a big, ugly white fly, and you hook up. And so my wife loves it because she only has to cast 20 feet.
That's the old Jose Wajeve style.
Exactly.
He was one of my heroes.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah, and he fished with I'm sure you've heard of Terry Nugent. He's mm-hmm. a friend of mine. He did shows with Terry, and it was really sad the way.
I miss Jose.
Yeah. For the viewers who don't know, he died in a plane crash.
Plane crash, yeah. He was the Spanish Fly.
Exactly. Yeah.
The Spanish Fly and Walker's Cay Chronicles. Those were the two shows that got me into being a passionate fly fisherman.
Yeah.
Flip Pallet and Jose Wajeve.
Great ambassadors for fly fishing.
Yeah. And my new love is the new fly fisher.
Uh-huh.
With Colin McEwen and Phil Rowley and Bill Spicer.
Okay.
Those guys. Okay. But I really loved Jose. And I love that because he was just a fisherman. I mean, yeah, fly fishing was a passion of his. But he would throw some bait. He would throw some spinning rod. And down there in Florida, you just catch fish, you know.
And he appreciated everything else, you know. The whole ecosystem.
With
birds, the mammals, everything.
And his bare feet. He'd always be on the beach with his bare feet and his jeans.
Expounding on this and that.
Jose Wajeve. Well, how about we dedicate this podcast to Jose?
Good idea.
We'd be okay with that?
Absolutely.
Well, great. Ted, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. How can people know more about the Native Fish Coalition?
Just log on to our website, read all the chapters we have. I do the blog. You can click on that. You can leave comments. I usually try to put up 2 or 3 links or articles a day.
That's phenomenal.
So, I get a lot of good links from my friends on Facebook. So we have a lot of fishing friends. You're one of them.
Yes. Thank you.
So it's been fun, and it's a good way to communicate with the public about fish.
Ted, it's been an absolute pleasure. Is it nativefishcoalition.org?
Yeah, just Google Native Fish Coalition.
There we go.
And you'll come up.
You'll find you.
You'll find the website and the blog.
Thank you very much for taking time out of your show to be on our podcast, Ted. It's been an absolute pleasure learning about you, your life, your story. Thank you for your conservation efforts, for all fly fishing as a whole, and for what you do.
Well, good to be with you, Rob. Good luck.
Thanks, Ted.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.